ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm taking my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
A simmering scandal at accounting firm KPMG has reached a boiling point with multiple heads rolling and admissions about poor handling of a whistleblower's complaint. And once again, it's raising questions about how the big four accounting firms operate here in Australia. Meanwhile, tariff threats from the United States have surfaced once again. What exactly does it mean for Australian businesses? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm Tansy Harcourt, senior reporter with The Australian.
Tansy, thank you so much for joining us in the studio, our first outside the ABC guest. And we wanted to get you on because you have been following this scandal so closely. And I know you've had to deal with rolling new information coming at you thick and fast. Take us back, because I think for a lot of people it's quite a complicated story. What is KPMG accused of and what have they admitted to so far?
If you wind it back to when this first became public, Senator Deb O'Neill aired under parliamentary privilege a bunch of claims by a whistleblower. And among those claims were allegations that senior audit partners had misused confidential documents belonging to specific clients. The client that they named in relation to that was Lendlease, and then used those documents to help win the work of other clients. And some of the other names that the whistleblower mentioned was Macquarie Group, Dexus, Westpac. That was it for the ones that were named at that point in time. Now, up until that point, the whistleblower only went to Deb O'Neill 2 years after they first blew the whistle internally at KPMG.
So this is back in 2024.
Back in 2024. And at that point in time, an investigation of sorts, in inverted commas, took place, and the whistleblower was effectively shown the door. The firm decided there was nothing to see here.
People need to understand these big four accounting firms, they have fingers in lots of pies, don't they? They have businesses that cross into lots of different areas, but there are very strict rules, understandably, about not utilising information you have in part of your business or the work you're doing on behalf of certain clients in order to then win you business elsewhere. And so the accusation really goes to the trust about how these organisations are utilising the information that they have access to.
Well, exactly. And look, it can be a little bit different. If you look at the big four firms, so that's KPMG, PwC, EY and Deloitte, they have units that span from audit, tax and consulting. And the consultants have always been a little bit, more flexible with what they do. But the auditing division, that's, historically, those guys are the super straight, really nerdy people. They're basically the watchdog for the market. So they need to be completely independent and they need to have absolutely no conflicts. I mean, they all should have no conflicts, but it's particularly important for auditors.
We have seen now multiple heads roll at KPMG, but what have they actually admitted they've done wrong? In addition to, at least they say that they recognise that they did not treat the whistleblower's complaint in the way that they should have.
Well, they are obfuscating, for want of a better word, in terms of coming clean with what they've done and when approached, which I feel like I approach them kind of 15 times a day at the moment, as I'm sure every other journalist does too. They say, well, they've got to let the kind of the investigation unfold, the new investigation into what happened. But what they have admitted to one of their clients, Lendlease, is that confidential board documents that they shouldn't have been looking at all had been accessed by several senior audit partners. So that's the only thing that they have confirmed, not to the media, but only to that client, Lendlease.
And Lendlease has then told Senator O'Neill.
Lendlease told Senator O'Neill. But what we also know is that they have also told Singtel Optus that their documents were also inappropriately accessed. And that was in the hope that they would then be able to win the bigger cat in town, being Telstra, which they didn't win actually anyway.
So we've lost CEO Andrew Yates. Also, Julian McPherson is the National Managing Partner of Audit, and the COO, Eileen Hoggett, as well. Do you expect that we are going to see further displacements of executives at this organisation?
Displacements is a very nice way of putting it. I think we will see further displacements, to put it in your words. I think Eileen Hoggett, she's only been demoted.
It's definitely a demotion.
Yeah, so she was the Chief Operating Officer for the whole region, not just for Australia. She was under immense pressure internally to resign. She didn't resign, but she has stepped back into her senior audit partner role. Interestingly, that hasn't gone down very well with one of her major clients. She was the signing partner for Dexus, which is also named as part of the parliamentary privilege whistleblower complaints. And Dexus has very quickly responded to KPMG and publicly and just said she's not welcome on our account anymore. So I'm not quite sure what she will be doing, because I suspect there will be quite a few corporates that don't really want her as their signing partner until the complete investigation is finished.
So KPMG has had other scandals in recent years.
It has.
Including a cheating on exam scandal.
Ethics exams, no less, yes.
Exactly. And also regarding the way that it was dealing with a New South Wales government account. But perhaps in many people's mind, the biggest scandal recently was PwC's scandal when it came to taxation arrangements and its access to government information. How does this current scandal compare to that? What are the similarities and what are the differences?
So interestingly, this only came to light because of Senator Deb O'Neill. The PwC scandal also came to light because of the work of the Parliamentary Joint Committee. And I must say, those senators, if you look at Deb O'Neill and Barbara Pocock and others, they've just done an incredible job of airing allegations that would have otherwise never been known about. So in the case of PwC, which I'm sure many people will remember, that was a tax partner taking confidential documents that the government had given that partner so that they could kind of help tweak their so-called Google tax laws, and then taking that information and using it to try and win work for the Googles of the world. So that was on the consulting tax side of things. And this one is kind of sitting fairly squarely in the, well, at this point in time anyway, in the audit side. But both are massive conflicts. As I have mentioned a few times in my articles for The Australian, it's really this issue of profit over principles, which I think that when you are seeing that in your kind of watchdog, that's quite concerning. I mean, what do you think?
I mean, one of the things I found most extraordinary about this particular scandal is that KPMG actually provides whistleblower advice to other organisations, including the RBA.
Yeah.
So you have this organisation who is helping other companies put in place processes to make sure that whistleblower complaints are heard and dealt with appropriately, and by their own admission, have completely failed again in this particular episode. And also the fact that it took 2 years from the whistleblower raising these concerns, it appears, and it has now taken someone from the parliament to actually raise them under parliamentary privilege, which obviously means that they can't be sued and they have special powers that even journalists don't have. That seems one of the most extraordinary parts of this to me. And also what is now being raised, which I must admit I wasn't fully aware of this, that because they're a partner model, the way that these big four operate, that they don't have the same responsibilities and they're not treated in the same way that a commercial organization would be, a for-profit corporation. And so it appears that the punishment available to be meted out to them isn't as strong as it would be if they were operating under a different model. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And there's a few pieces to that. But so the Corps Act, which is, you know, what most companies sit under has very strong rules about all sorts of things. One of which is whistleblower rules. And if you take the time to read the Corps Act, it actually specifically separates out big auditing and consulting firms. They're not caught up in it. It's written in the Act.
They're completely carved out of those particular parts of the legislation.
And that, to me, seems odd and obviously needs to be changed. So there's that side of things. And then there's also the issue of what happens if something goes wrong. And there's a court case that I think is about to start kind of kicking off that has been brought by another former KPMG partner who is a former whistleblower. I suppose he's still a whistleblower of sorts. But
yes, I think you keep the title for life, right? This is Brendan Lyon, yeah. the whistleblower who's involved with the scandal about the way that KPMG was valuing assets on behalf of the New South Wales government, transport assets, right?
Yes. So Mr. Lyon, he's now an academic at the University of Wollongong, and he's raised really serious issues around the fact that there's a limited liability that any of these firms face if something goes wrong. So we'll see how that one plays out in court. But basically, no whistleblower protections and limited liability if something goes wrong. So,
and part of his argument is the potential penalties are so small for organisations like KPMG that actually it can just be a cost of doing business, because gaining these contracts can be so lucrative. You know, talking about tens of millions of dollars in different, depending on how
hundreds of millions of dollars.
So if you're only facing penalties that are relatively small, then maybe you just take that into account and think it's worth the risk.
Yeah.
Where do you think this leaves the reputation of these big organisations? I mean, when we look at PwC, it did seem to hurt them, and it seemed to hurt the organisation in terms of gaining new contracts. In fact, it looks like KPMG, part of the reason they were interested in getting some access to some of this information allegedly, would be to get an advantage over PwC, which was losing clients. Do you think this stuff does matter to their reputation and their ability to do business, and is there enough in the way of punishment for the individuals involved to stop it from occurring in the future?
Well, I mean, I think it matters a great deal. The big four firms, since the PwC scandal, which is 4 or 5 years ago, depending on when you want to put a marker in it, that changed the way corporates and the government dealt with the big four firms. And the Albanese government at the time was very outspoken. But what's happened since then is not very much
Yes, I was surprised by this. Yeah, why did it stall, the move to change the regulations to ensure that such a scandal didn't happen again?
That's a conversation I seem to be having quite frequently with the government, because the Parliamentary Joint Committee came up with 12 recommendations. Now, this is the group that had, you know, investigated the whole PwC scandal in the first place and is now looking at KPMG. So they were in a position to know, and they had 12 recommendations. Only three of those were given the sign off, and then there were several that were taken under notice, and a bunch of them that were just ignored completely. I think that is something that needs to be revisited. The other thing is, the Treasury was supposed to be coming forward with a big program looking at how big four fit into the ecosystem, and that isn't on their regulatory initiative grid at all for 2027.
This is the stuff that they plan to do.
Yes, although it's not on there. In saying that, I haven't looked at it today, but it certainly wasn't there earlier in the week. So, what is happening?
The Greens seem to be pushing for auditing to be removed, to be hived off from the big four, effectively, right?
They think
that it is so crucial, and the auditing is, you know, it's supposed to be kind of the overseer, right, to make sure that what's been done before is up to scratch. Do you think that's an argument that's becoming more popular? Is that a possibility? And would have it actually made a difference when it comes to this particular scandal?
Two good questions there. I think it definitely could be a possibility. There are regulations in the UK that separate the divisions. So they've got to have a different management structure, right, and pay is completely separated. The European Union also has it's not exactly like the UK model, but similar. It's not as if the Greens are just coming up with something crazy. They're not trying to reinvent the wheel. I think that's something that I would assume will be reconsidered. I mean, Barbara Pocock has been very outspoken about that, and she's got some very valid points. It's a system that has worked elsewhere. But to your second question, would it have made any difference? It's really hard to know, because these guys were just, they weren't trying to give that auditing work then to help the consultants. This was very much
An internal audit issue.
Yes, an internal audit issue. And I think that has to come down to being a cultural problem. And I know that's such an, you know, a cheesy and overused word, but perhaps people don't recognise it when they have a good culture, but you really see it when there's a bad one.
And then that question becomes, how do you ensure good culture, and does it have to be personal liability, the potential of personal punishment, in order to make sure that people are adhering to the standards that we think that they should be if they're in these type of roles?
Exactly. And I mean, in your line of work, how often do you look at a company and think, wow, that there must be something, they must be doing something right, because everyone seems to be kind of singing from the same hymn sheet?
Yeah, I think that's a really difficult question, isn't it? About how, and you know, people, again, it does sound cheesy, setting the tone at the top. And on this occasion, you have now the CEO has resigned. The chairman, there's questions around the chairman. Is that fair to say?
Very big
and
questions.
Particularly, you also point out there's questions about the chairman's relationship with another member of the firm who sits in the audit group.
Not a question about the relationship in and of itself, because obviously
that's public.
That is public, but it's more about the ability of the board to investigate the matter in the way that it should have been done, given the conflict between a senior audit partner who was in a relationship with the chairman.
And one of the other things that I was struck in your reporting was how interrelated these organisations are. For example, with KPMG having a former KPMG auditor is now on the board of Westpac.
And heads their audit committee.
And at one point was staying over
at Martin Shepherd's house,
which is the chairman of KPMG currently.
Yes.
Now, there is no allegation at that time that it was inappropriate in itself, right? But it does, again, just go to how interrelated these organisations are.
It does, exactly, because I think in some ways it would be sad if Peter Nash was not friends with Martin Shepherd, given they worked together for a long time. So that is not a problem, but it is just in terms of the perception of having a completely clean skin and there being no bias, probably around the time that the auditor is being chosen, it's not a good time to be having a sleepover. I will say that Westpac had made sure that Peter Nash wasn't on there was a special
subcommittee for this.
So he didn't have anything to do with the choosing of KPMG as the auditor. But it really is a bit of a kind of, when you look at the pub test question that we all love in Australia, probably doesn't pass it.
This has kind of rolled on now over a series of months, although it does, as we said in the intro, it seems that it was simmering and now it has hit a boiling point. How do you think this does play out in the coming couple of weeks? Do we see more heads rolling? Do we see major changes in the structure of the organisation?
I had a piece in the paper this morning about a company called Capgemini, which is trying to buy KPMG's defence unit.
The vultures circling, I believe, is the expression?
Yes. I mean, that's an interesting one. KPMG rebuffed their $1 offer, but the view is that they'll be back, because that KPMG defence team, at one point, that was the biggest earner for KPMG in Australia. And the money that they were earning from defence had fallen off a cliff as a result of the big PwC scandal. All of the government contractors were told to kind of rein in their spending with the big four. So it had already dramatically dropped. And now that this has happened, those defence consultants are staring down the barrel of a whole lot of nothing. So they quite naturally would like to find a new home. And if they don't find a new home quickly, they will face another set of problems, because Senator Deb O'Neill, who has been so integral to shining a light on the consulting industry, has now just taken over the Parliamentary Joint Committee that's just been set up a couple of weeks ago looking at defence.
Right.
So I think
she could be very important in the defence sphere going forward.
I don't think that she really loves the way KPMG has behaved over this. Mm.
Yeah, fascinating. One to watch, and people should be reading your great work in The Australian. Now, one of the other interesting things that's happened for the Australian economy was, once again, the US seems to be trying to brick up its tariff war. Now, people might remember Donald Trump last year, cast our minds back. He had the Liberation Day tariffs where he announced sweeping tariffs on almost every country on earth. Now, Australia was relatively well treated in that first tranche. We had the minimum baseline tariff, 10%. Wasn't great, worse than it was before, but it was relatively good. Donald Trump has faced a lot of setbacks in his attempts to keep the tariff wall strong, including the Supreme Court overturning most of those tariffs. Now, we knew that he was trying to find a solution to the problem. The man is very wedded to tariffs. This is one of the through lines throughout his political career. Sometimes Donald Trump can seem to be jumping all over the map politically, but he seems to genuinely believe tariffs are a good thing for the American economy.
He loves a tariff.
He loves a tariff. And so now we have this situation where the suggestion is Australia will be paying a slightly higher tariff than we currently are, 12.5%. Australia is kind of in the bad group. There's a group that's going to get a 10% tariff, which includes the European Union and the UK. They're still getting a 10% tariff, but they're in the good group. Australia's in a group with China, Japan, South Korea, India. We're in the bad group. The argument seems to be that we're not good when it comes to the issues of slavery in supply chains or where we're purchasing our products. I mean, can you make much sense of that?
Not really. I mean, this one's right back to you, Carrington. Has there been, as far as I know, there hasn't been any specific examples he's given. What are you hearing?
It's important to point out that the Prime Minister has refuted any claim that Australia is somehow weak when it comes to the issue of slavery within the production of goods.
Mm.
If you were cynical, you might think the reason they've done this is because they needed to find a solution. Basically, the Supreme Court said that the particular act they had used for the sweeping Liberation Day tariffs, they had misused. But there are many other types of tariffs that the US still has in place that they have gone through a process where they do a report, they do an investigation, which could be about dumping of cheap products, for example, steel tariffs or sector-specific tariffs, and they have to go through some sort of a process where they look into whether or not individual countries are breaking trade law. This seems like a pretty easy one, I guess, for them to do, because I guess it's pretty hard to prove otherwise. It's out for consultation now. We wait to see how it's implemented. I find it confusing, and particularly compared to what America is doing. I think many people would say Australia has done more when it comes to ensuring that the supply chains aren't utilizing slavery in the production of goods. But I think he has a very clear ticking clock. His solution to the Supreme Court knocking back his Liberation Day tariffs was to do another emergency measure, but it had a set period and it's due to expire in July, which is what he's used, what is in place currently. So they need a solution to kind of plug the hole after that. The one thing that does surprise me about this is you have the midterm elections coming up pretty quickly and the increasing price of goods in America, largely driven by the war in the Middle East, interruption of global energy supply, is hurting them politically. So I would have thought he might be looking for a bit of an off-ramp instead of hiking the tariffs on imports, which is only going to lead to higher prices. Perhaps he would be looking for maybe allowing them to lapse. But he's obviously a man who believes in this, and he does love the revenue that's coming. I think, unfortunately, for Australian producers and businesses, it's another confusing thing to deal with the American system, but it is only a relatively small, we think, increase over what they're currently paying.
Well, what do you think then about the way, I mean, it's very hard to predict Donald Trump, obviously, but how do you feel about the way the Australian government has handled this? And it's obviously just been announced, but what do you think about the way they're trying to tackle Trump on things like this?
You know, it's a very interesting question. I mean, there was arguments when the Liberation Day tariffs came out about do you go kind of do the Chinese option, which was, well, we'll hit them back. If America's hitting us with 40%, 50% tariffs, then we'll hit them with the same. First of all, China's a much bigger entity. It has more negotiating power. It also has hurt the Chinese economy to be involved in this tit for tat with America, but perhaps they're playing the long game. I think the Australian government's position was keep your head down. we're not the major target. We're not being treated worse than other similar countries, so therefore you're better off not getting in his way. Has that actually worked? Not really, but maybe it would have been worse if you'd gone in another direction. The truth is, I don't think any country has handled, it doesn't matter which response you've had, it doesn't seem to have worked. No country has achieved tariffs being completely lifted off.
No.
The UK tried to do the deal, remember?
They even rolled out the king,
yeah. Got the invitation out there, and yet they still ended up with a pretty similar position to what they started with. So I don't think there is a way of dealing with Donald Trump that makes a lot of sense. I think they were hoping, as happened in the first term, that eventually he would roll over, and perhaps he will after the midterms. But I don't know if anyone thinks there would have been a better outcome for trying to get into a fight with Donald Trump. He doesn't like that either. Well, that's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. Tomorrow, be sure to catch That's Business with Alan Kohler, who will be sitting down with Adelaida Soldashek, one of Australia's foremost experts on childcare, to unpack the childcare industry. Where is it? Where reform might need to happen, and the government's appetite to make those changes. And I'll be back in your feeds on Monday. Remember, to never miss an episode, make sure you're following ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to send in a question, email abcbusinessdaily@abc.net.au. Catch you next time, Tansy.
Thanks, Carrington. A pleasure.